Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 91. It's Monday, December 7th. I am recording this show from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. I am recording this show on December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day, the 79th anniversary. In 1941, 2,403 Americans were killed in the attack on Pearl Harbor. This number of 2,403 eerily resembles the number of Americans dying daily from COVID-19. Yet this viral attack of COVID-19 on our nation is not a single tragic day triggering war. This viral attack is not even merely a surge. This viral attack has been predicted by public health experts for months and months. As predictable as any flu season, the question now is only how terrible. This is simply the predicted deadly pandemic flu season that public health experts have warned about for literally years, even decades. I'd like to begin with part of a commentary by Dr. Sanjay Gupta, the main medical correspondent for CNN. If the United States were my patient, science cannot rescue us from ourselves. This past week has been so bad that according to one calculation from the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington, COVID-19 was the leading cause of death in the United States, beating out coronary heart disease. As hospitals start to max out, medical workers beg officials for new COVID-19 mandates. Redundancies, escape hatches, reserves, call them what you will, but they no longer exist for the patient, the country. Now, state after state reports hospital systems reaching their breaking points. It's not just that there are fewer hospital beds available, but frontline healthcare workers and support staff, from doctors and nurses to orderlies to the hospital cleaning crews, are getting fatigued, worn out, and sick themselves in ever-growing numbers, and there is no one to replace them. The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation predicted that states would respond once we hit the threshold of 8 people per million dying, and that the country's defense mechanisms would be triggered, leading to measures such as stay-at-home orders being reinstated. Well, 8 people per million dying works out to about 2,800 deaths per day, and we're already past that. But the country's defense mechanisms haven't revved up on the large-scale basis needed. While many people in this country wear masks and follow physical distancing guidelines, too many still do not. Mask wearing continues to be a political statement and is not mandatory in 15 states. Only 7 states have any kind of stay-at-home orders, advisories, or curfew, over which many a battle has been waged. And the end is indeed in sight. Help in the form of one or more vaccines is on the horizon. This patient, our country, will survive, of course. But any imminent vaccine, while nothing short of a scientific and logistical miracle, won't be an immediate fix. It will take time, several months to half a year, to distribute it to communities everywhere. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, how many Americans will we let die in the meantime? According to the most recent Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation model, the number of projected COVID-19 deaths could decrease by 66,000 by April if just 59% of people wore masks. Think about it. One of those lives saved could be your own mothers, your elderly neighbors, your favorite musicians, or the next brilliant scientist. It could even be your life or mine. In addition to wearing masks, we must restrict our activities and reduce capacity at certain types of businesses. A modeling study by researchers at Stanford and Northwestern universities shows that a small minority of places people visit account for a large majority of coronavirus infections in big cities, and it suggests that reducing the maximum occupancy in such places, including restaurants, gyms, cafes, hotels, and religious establishments, can slow the spread of illness substantially. This type of move will, of course, cause the patient a certain amount of pain, so leaders should be prepared to offer pain medications. In this metaphor, morphine comes in the form of money for those suffering an economic stimulus. One thing has become clear. Our patient, that is our country, does not like taking small incremental steps like those outlined by countless public health experts. Instead, the patient, our country, likes the big Hail Mary grand gestures. We are the quick fix shortcut society, always hoping for the magic cures and potions, instead of leaning into the simple effective tools which require a little more work. As a result, my patient doesn't want to wear a mask and skip holidays with the family and friends. They just want a vaccine to hurry up and return us to life as normal. Our human spirit has made us innovative, creative, resourceful, and tenacious enough to see this dream of a vaccine bear fruit. But it's our human behavior and biological reflexes that will dictate how deep our wounds ultimately will go. No amount of science can rescue us from ourselves. I can only hope that this country's self-preservation instincts kicks in soon and long enough to get as many of us over the finish line as possible.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, let's take a look at Ohio and see what's in store for us and perhaps the rest of the nation, and then we'll get on to the local update. But let's start first with this from MSN. Coronavirus, Ohio on its own travel advisory list? Visiting the state is discouraged. Ohio is now among 14 states on the latest travel advisory list as COVID-19 continues to surge through the state and the nation. This is the first week since April where Ohio's positivity for COVID-19 has increased above 15%. The state has seen record levels of cases, deaths, and hospitalizations in the past week, and all Ohioans can help to limit the spread and impact of this virus. This includes recommendations to stay at home except for necessary trips for supplies, consistent mask wearing when around others, and frequent hand washing, the Ohio Department of Health stated in its release. Those who enter Ohio after travel to states reporting positivity rates of 15% or higher are advised to self-quarantine for 14 days. This applies to visitors and residents. Also, people from other states are encouraged to avoid travel to Ohio. Now, of course, this sets up a really odd thing, is that Ohioans should not be traveling in their own state. Of course, we can't order that, but we can ask people. Sets up a really odd thing. So this is just one of those weird, ironic stories where If we follow this guidance, it basically says every Ohioan who has basically left their house should self-quarantine for 14 days, which in essence would be because I'm kind of a lockdown order. So, well, that's kind of the ironic twist that you get when you try to give travel advisories, keeping people from other states with high rates out, when in fact Ohio's rate is so high that we meet our own criteria of dangerous to travel in or through. Okay, well, of course, you know, cases and hospitalizations, you know, lag quite a bit. But I wanted to do this little story here from the Cleveland Plain Dealer about deaths. Why Ohio's coronavirus death toll likely is worse than the 430 reported in the last week. The death toll from the coronavirus in Ohio likely is about to become more grim than indicated by the record number of 430 fatalities reported in the last week. This is the result of a combination of factors. Both new cases and hospitalizations spiked sharply through November, milestones often reached weeks before death. And once death occurs, it routinely takes several days to weeks before being reported by the Ohio Department of Health. The health department reported 119 deaths last Tuesday, the third highest single day total to date. Yet close to half of these deaths occurred more than a week earlier. 10 of the cases date back to October. One is from September 21st. The point is that in looking at the trend for deaths, the numbers are very likely underreported at this point, as they relate to the latest surge in cases that began in October and accelerated through November. So when you hear that, you know, that so many people have died today, it's actually kind of a misnomer because there is such a lag. You're really talking mostly people from the last week, but then a significant number of people from 2, 3, or even 4 or 5 weeks ago. So as a lagging indicator, it's what people pay attention the most, but the pipeline we're already in is going to produce a lot of deaths that will not be reported for weeks and weeks. Okay, and this from WLWT in Cincinnati. Not sustainable. Doctors give firsthand accounts of COVID fight in regions' rural areas. With 1 out of 3 patients across Ohio in an ICU having COVID, in our rural hospitals, it's actually 50 to 60%, said Dr. Andy Thomas of the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. So more than 1 out of every 2 patients in rural regions in the ICU have COVID. That's not sustainable. Staffing is a major concern. There are shortages, healthcare workers are getting sick, and healthy ones are exhausted. It's not just a nursing shortage. A registered nurse with the tenure and training to work on an inpatient floor where all the patients are there with respiratory failure to some degree, and what that means is they require oxygen or they require oxygen with a pump to push it in you, and the biggest form of that pump is a ventilator. That is not very RN. The hospitals are just flooded right now, so people are sitting for 12, 15, 16 hours waiting to be transported. And at this point, there's nothing anybody can do about it, said Dr. Chase Martin. Martin said he encounters patients on a regular basis who do not believe the virus is real or didn't until they contracted coronavirus themselves. He encouraged community members to take the pandemic seriously. And in more news about the various breaking points of our healthcare system, it's not an on-off switch either. It's fixed or it's broken. There are many layers of what broken is. This from the Washington Post. Pandemic is pushing America's 911 system to the breaking point, ambulance operators say. The coronavirus pandemic has pushed America's 911 system and emergency responders to a breaking point, with ambulance workers and their services financially strained. The strain could result in longer wait times and some providers going out of business, ambulance operators said. Ambulance providers are struggling to meet surging demand even while grappling with increased costs of personal protective equipment, overtime, staff shortages as workers fall ill, and decreases in the type of emergency calls that are reimbursed. Even before the pandemic, the nation's 911 system was strained. Across the country, 911 calls are answered by a patchwork of nonprofit, for-profit, hospital-affiliated, fire department, and municipal-run services. As some ambulance services go out of business, others from neighboring counties will have to cover those areas, industry leaders said. To cut costs, some may keep fewer ambulances in the field. Both scenarios would result in longer wait times. Rural areas, which already struggle with wait times and coverage, could be especially hard hit. Under the quirks of the U.S. healthcare system, while ambulances respond to all manner of 911 calls, They are often only reimbursed when they transport people to the hospital. During the pandemic, calls for medical help in many areas have surged by several hundredfold in some cases, but those resulting in transport to hospitals have fallen. As hospitals throughout the country become overwhelmed, many ambulance services have been told to treat patients in place whenever possible and transport only the most acute cases to protect hospital capacity. In New Rochelle, New York, for instance, one of the country's earliest epicenters for the virus, 911 calls for medical help that didn't result in transport increased from 5,000 to 6,049 this year. Meanwhile, transport volume declined 25%. At the same time, operation costs have ballooned. Providers are having to disinfect ambulances after each call and provide testing for their staff. Personal protective equipment has been expensive and hard to find. EMTs are often the first healthcare workers to interact with infectious coronavirus patients. They are the ones who put a mask on patients before they even enter hospitals, and many ambulance workers have been hit hard by the virus. And this from the Columbus Dispatch. Ohio nursing home residents, workers move to front line for COVID-19 vaccine priority. Ohio's plan to begin distributing hundreds of thousands of doses of COVID-19 vaccines around December 15th now falls in line with federal recommendations. Nursing home residents and workers will be among the first to be inoculated. An independent panel recommended to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that healthcare workers and nursing home residents be vaccinated first, while Ohio's original plan had placed nursing home residents in the second wave of vaccinations. Medically fragile nursing home residents and staff have proven particularly vulnerable to COVID-19 in mid-group settings, accounting for 10% of all virus infections and 58% of all deaths in Ohio. Also, in the first phase for vaccinations are those in state psychiatric hospitals and veterans' homes and people with mental disabilities and illness, plus the staff who care for them in group homes, DeWine said. I wanted to point this out because I think this is a proper aligning with what makes sense. Nationwide, about 40%, and that's probably an underestimate, of people with COVID-19 that have died have been residents of nursing homes. In Ohio, of course, this is 58% that was reported here. But I also thought it was important, since we focus a lot on long-term care facilities, we think of those for the elderly, but also people with mental disabilities and illness are also in congregate facilities that are very high risk and have had high rates of infection and death. So I'm glad to see that those are included in the Ohio priorities now. Okay, and another change in recommendations that may be good news, this from Medscape. CDC shortens COVID-19 quarantine to 10 or 7 days with conditions. The U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention announced two shorter quarantine options, 10 days or 7 days, for people exposed to COVID-19, citing new evidence and a, quote, acceptable risk of transmission. The agency hopes reducing the 14-day quarantine will increase overall compliance and improve public health and economic constraints. These shorter quarantine options do not replace initial CDC guidance. CDC continues to recommend quarantine for 14 days as the best way to reduce risk for spreading COVID-19, said Dr. Henry Walk, the CDC's COVID-19 incident manager. However, after reviewing and analyzing new research and data, CDC has identified two acceptable alternative quarantine periods. People can now quarantine for 10 days without a COVID-19 test if they have no symptoms. Alternatively, a quarantine can end after 7 days for someone with a negative test and no symptoms. The agency recommends a PCR test or an antigen assay within 48 hours before the end of a quarantine. Okay, just to be clear, that means if you want to end your quarantine at 7 days, you need to be tested 2 or 3 days prior to that, particularly since it takes 2 or 3 or more days to get a test result back. Obviously, if you got tested at day 7 and didn't get your test back for 3 or 4 days, your 10-day quarantine would be over anyways. So how possible that is going to depend a lot on local situations and the testing turnaround. The agency also suggests people still monitor for symptoms for a full 14 days. Reducing the length of quarantine may make it easier for people to take this crucial public health action by reducing the economic hardship associated with a longer period, especially if they cannot work during that time. In addition, a shorter quarantine period can lessen stress on the public health system and communities, especially when new infections are rapidly rising. The federal guidance leaves flexibility for local jurisdictions to make their own quarantine recommendations as warranted. Okay, well, let's get to the local COVID-19 update. In Lucas County, for the average daily cases over the last 7 days, we're at around 300, which is actually a drop from where we were the last time we reported, closer to 350. But of course, we're getting sort of a ceiling, kind of a capping of the amount of testing that we're apparently capable of. So this may be limiting the actual number of positives we're able to identify. And sure enough, if we look at the last week, oddly, the reporting just gives you an indication of the capacity of our local public health system. We reported 2,044 positives in the last 7 days, but we only reported 2,023 tests. Of course, that's physically impossible to have more positives than tests. And of course, like I've mentioned before in earlier shows, there's a lag between the negative tests being reported. The positives are reported first, and they're a priority, but there's apparently can be quite a lag for the total number of tests, the remaining negative tests to be reported. Okay, but if we go out 2 weeks, then we start seeing a little bit more accurate test date, and we can calculate the positivity there. So if we look at 2 weeks, we have 4,542 positives, just over 12,000 tests, and this is a positivity rate of 37%. Now, the previous period that I reported in the last show, it was at 27%. So it looks like that we're trending up with that from terrible to even more terrible. And it looks like the total number of tests that we're doing is actually trending down. This 2 week period of reported tests had 870 tests per day, and we were doing over 1,000 tests per day in earlier periods. And in Ohio, statewide, which is going to be a little bit more complete reporting, the most recent day for a 7 day average showed a 15.9 positivity rate. Wow, that just keeps going up. Okay, well, in some good news, locally, the average time for a positive test result to be returned has gone down from over 4 days to under 4 days. This is good news. Of course, part of this may be due to the fact that the total test performed is trending down. So like I said, we may be reaching sort of a leveling or a ceiling of the number of tests we're able to do, which is the number of tests we're able to do and report on. We're just not doing more than that. Okay, well, let's turn to nursing homes. We had 146 active cases reported in the most recent week. And this is compared to 161 the previous week and 134 the week prior to that. So it looks like it's staying about the same or going down a little bit. So we're sort of holding our own, although that's a pretty high number. And the thing that's really scary is that the positivity rate, the proportion of tests that are positive, of people that are tested in long-term care facilities, is now 19.4%. And this has doubled in just about 3 weeks, the positivity rate. Yikes. Okay, well, as cases are getting less and less accurate reporting the underlying epidemic, we need to start actually looking at deaths. And while it lags, deaths are reported, albeit they may be late, might be weeks, as I reported earlier in the show. But Lucas County death rate is jumping up. We had a total of 41 deaths in the last 14 days, and the overall death rate is above state and national death rates. Not good news. Of course, this is likely only to worsen over the next couple months. Okay, well, University of Toledo is out of school now, but the last week that they were in session, at least a part of the week that they did reporting, they had 66 positives. As compared to 59 from the week before. They didn't do surveillance testing, the kind of more random testing. I think this is still related to the fact that they had, while students were leaving, the health department had come in and done some testing, so they stopped their regular surveillance testing. And also, UT Medical Center may be putting their testing resources elsewhere. I'm not entirely sure about that. But they're out of school, so I won't have to worry about that for a number of weeks. Okay, well, since we had a school shutdown order for Lucas County schools, we've only got one last week, or perhaps partial week, as schools closed down as of last Friday at the latest. We had slightly more cases than the prior week that reported. And the only difference there is that it tended to be more staff and less students, but more total cases. And as far as Ohio is concerned, Ohio has jumped from 4 to 9 purple counties in the last week, purple being the highest level of alert and emergency level. So 8 of the 88 counties are now purple. And of course, there are quite a few that are lying in wait because you have to have 2 weeks where you meet the criteria for purple before you're actually designated as purple. Okay, well, let's look to something that, of course, is the good news story as far as the horizon for ending this horrific pandemic and epidemic in this country is vaccines. But as I've said before, it's going to be difficult to do well. So let's do a little reporting on that. This from the Washington Post. Trump's Operation Warp Speed promised a flood of COVID vaccines. Instead, states are expecting a trickle. Federal officials have slashed the amount of coronavirus vaccine they plan to ship to states in December because of constraints on supply, sending local officials into a scramble to adjust vaccination plans and highlighting how early promises of a vast stockpile before the end of 2020 have fallen short. Instead of a delivery of 300 million or so doses of vaccine immediately after emergency use approval and before the end of 2020, as the Trump administration had originally promised, current plans for availability are about a tenth of that, or 35 to 40 million doses. Of course, with vaccines that take 2 doses per person. As planning accelerated for distributing supplies, the government began to further lower expectations. To make sure supplies don't run out and leave some people only partially immunized, the government said it would stagger deliveries to ensure that states have enough supply for the second shot, required 21 days later for the Pfizer vaccine, which is expected to be the first to gain approval. Lower than anticipated allocations have caused widespread confusion and concern in states, which are beginning to grasp the level of vaccine scarcity they will confront in the early going of the massive vaccination campaign. The gap reflects the disconnect between Trump's campaign promises, as well as the optimistic estimates from some drug companies and scientific and manufacturing realities. The drop-off is a product of manufacturing problems, bottlenecks in the supply of raw materials, and other hurdles in ramping up clinical trial production of 5 liters of protein-based vaccine at a time to commercial-scale fermentation of 2,000-liter batches, the companies in the Trump administration said. There were a couple of our vaccine candidates that took significantly longer in terms of failed batches, in terms of not having the purity we sought, Paul Mango, Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy at the Department of Health and Human Services, said in an interview. He declined to say which company experienced batch failures. We have cracked the code on these things, but we're 2 months behind on some of them, Mango said. Several states said they were expecting an allocation from Moderna about twice the size of the initial wave from Pfizer, roughly a week later. Pfizer is expected to win emergency authorization for its vaccine soon after the FDA Advisory Committee meets on December 10th. In November, the company cut its dose manufacturing projection for 2020 from 100 million doses to 50 million doses. It said it remains on track to produce 1.3 billion doses in 2021. The company's lower estimate got little notice at the time, tucked at the bottom of a November 9th news release announcing the stunning news that its vaccine was more than 90% effective. The news buoyed stock markets and triggered optimism that a solution to the pandemic was in sight. As Pfizer began large-scale production, the company said, it encountered difficulties procuring sufficient amounts of raw ingredients. A number of specialized materials are required to create the vaccine, including nucleotides, the building block of the mRNA, the basis of the vaccine. Bringing it all together in a first-time, very large-scale operation is no simple feat, said company spokeswoman Amy Rose. It's as complicated as the research and development piece. Moderna, a Massachusetts biotech company that has never before had a product on the market, did not make early public predictions of how much its mRNA vaccine it would produce by the end of 2020. The company said it's now on track to have 20 million doses available in December and between 500 million to 1 billion available by the end of 2021. As with Pfizer, Moderna's vaccine is a 2-shot regimen. The swing factor between 500 million, 100 billion, and 1 billion doses is raw materials. Moderna Chief Executive Stephen Bancel said in an interview, adding that as the company massively ramped up its production by a factor of 1,000 this year, the demand strained its supply chain. Some of our suppliers were not ready for that, of course, Bancel said. Moderna's vaccine supply chain depends critically on the availability and high quality of each component, including the lipids used to encapsulate the mRNA bags and laboratory equipment used in production, the chemical components of mRNA itself, and enzymes. If one ingredient is missing, we have to wait, Bantel said. AstraZeneca said early in the year it would begin delivering the first 300 million doses of viral vector vaccine to the United States in September, an ambitious prediction that passed unfulfilled. AstraZeneca declined to comment. Other companies have either declined to say how much vaccine they expect to have available or won't report phase 3 clinical data until later in 2021. Americans and state officials are already having to adjust their expectations to a slower rollout of vaccines. In Maine, the current proposed allotment would barely enable us to vaccinate emergency department and ICU frontline staff, said Nirav Shah, director of Maine's Center for Disease Control and Prevention and president-elect of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. Maine has about 6,000 emergency department and intensive care frontline staff who would meet the criteria to be vaccinated in the initial round, state officials said. Few officials seem to know exactly why they are receiving fewer doses. There has been some lack of clarity in terms of what states are going to get, said Rachel Levine, Pennsylvania's health secretary and president of the State Health Official Association. We're not crystal clear. The initial supply will not even touch all of our hospitals, said Mandy Cohen, secretary of the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. We knew this was going to be a process, and we've tried to set expectations on the front end. The government's decision to hold back the booster shot, Cohen said, adds a new layer of complexity. I think one of the hardest pieces of this is the matching of the first dose to the second dose and getting the timing exactly right, she said. In the trial setting, when Pfizer and Moderna did that, it's a very controlled setting. We don't have data to say what happens if you come in on day 22. We'll be working very hard to follow the protocols. Federal officials claiming the expected arrival of vaccines are also begging people to be patient. We'll have more and more people getting vaccinated, said Admiral Brett Giroir, the Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services during a visit to Louisiana, saying most Americans will have to wait until May or June. Experts agree the administration's plan to pay companies billions of dollars in advance to spur manufacturing in parallel to the initiation of clinical trials, a strategy never attempted on such a massive scale, must still be considered a success. The advance payments eliminated or reduced financial risk for the companies, which have raced to ramp up production of doses that are still in the pipeline, if coming slower than originally pledged. They have done better than I could have imagined they could have done, said Barry Bloom, professor and expert in immunology and infectious diseases at the Harvard School of Public Health. Each of the coronavirus vaccine manufacturers contracted with the government, with the exception of Pfizer, will get paid for delivery stockpiles of vaccine even if they fail to win emergency authorization, according to Operation Warp Speed. Together, the six received advance purchase orders of $9.3 billion, according to a tally by analysts at the Wall Street firm Bernstein. Some received additional supplies of hundreds of millions of dollars for research and development. This money certainly has been important in helping these companies build out their manufacturing capacity ahead of time. It's just that it's really hard to do so, said Rachel Sachs, a law professor and specialist in pharmaceutical pricing at Washington University in St. Louis. Okay, well, we have success with the upfront funding of vaccine development and production. Unfortunately, we haven't done the same with vaccine distribution. This from The Hill. State, local officials plead for vaccine distribution funds. Public health experts say state and local governments are underfunded and unprepared for what is expected to be the largest vaccination campaign in U.S. history. While the Trump administration has spent more than $10 billion supporting the development of COVID-19 vaccines, just $340 million has been allocated to agencies below the federal level to help with distribution efforts that will cost anywhere from $6 to $13.3 billion, according to various estimates. Healthcare workers, nursing home residents, and other priority groups could be vaccinated as soon as this month, according to estimates by Trump officials. But the administration has not planned for the subsequent vaccination of hundreds of millions of Americans in the general population next year or how to pay for it. We knew vaccines would be in development, so it's not a surprise we would need to build up the deployment system. Now we could be weeks away from the first doses going out, and we really haven't invested in any of that work, said Adrian Casaletti, Chief of Government and Public Affairs at the National Association of County and City Health Officials. Things could have been done earlier without having to reach this level of emergency, she added. To not have put a single dime towards deployment of it is a real disservice. It's not I'm not getting a sense from Congress that there's a tremendous urgency on this, said Topher Spiro, Vice President for Health Policy at the left-leaning Center for American Progress. This effort is going to be on par, or should be on par, with landing a man on the moon. It should be one of the largest efforts ever undertaken by governments, and it's really important to get it right to restore faith in the government, and I don't understand why Congress would nickel and dime this funding. There's a huge risk of underfunding vaccine distribution, which would be catastrophic, he added. It's needed immediately. It was needed 6 months ago, said Claire Hannon, executive director of the Association of Immunization Managers. Hannon said she's less worried about the first phase, when healthcare workers and nursing home residents will likely be vaccinated, and more concerned about being prepared when larger groups of people will need to be vaccinated. Health departments are already strained from running contact tracing and testing programs while receiving very little money from the CDC to prepare for a vaccine rollout. Implementation will require more employees to train providers, staff vaccination clinics, and hire and train workers who will be tasked with launching outreach programs, purchasing more supplies, and engaging with hard-to-reach populations that are traditionally more distrustful of public health campaigns. This is all moving at a very slow pace right now, Hannon said. While a vaccine may not be available to the general public until spring, planning needs to take place several months before then in order for it to run smoothly, she said. You can't expect states to wait a couple of months to get funding and then in 24 hours begin vaccinating with it. It takes time, she said. Well, as I've said before, these two stories illustrate the huge difference in perception and priority that we have between kind of a medical or pharmaceutical approach versus a public health approach. We love having vaccines or curatives on the shelf, but getting those into the arms or the mouths, into the people who need them, is not that easy and involves a much more complex medical system and public health approach to reaching people. Okay, well, if you want to witness an even starker contrast between different worldviews, look at that of the criminal justice system and that of the healthcare system trying to be a healing place. This from Stat News. Replace the cold steel of hospital bed shackles with the warmth of compassion. Why do they have that cold steel on my son's ankle? The father of Jacob Blake, a 29-year-old black man who was newly paralyzed from the waist down, wanted to know why his son was shackled to his hospital bed. Jacob Blake had been shot in the back 7 times by police in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and the bullets had severed his spinal cord. He was absolutely no flight risk, yet a police officer had cuffed him to the bed. His father's question, which was echoed on front pages across the country, captured in 11 words an issue I've been grappling for years. I'm not saying there aren't times when a prisoner legitimately needs to be restrained when in civilian hospital for care. A colleague of mine told me about caring for a shackled violent prisoner with COVID-19 who lunged at one of the nurses. But the vast majority of shackled patients I have cared for have posed no flight risk or threat to anyone's safety. My first experience with a patient cuffed to the bed was many years ago on the East Coast. He was in his 70s, weak and wasted from illness. I knew he was a prisoner by the police officer sitting on the chair outside his room, armed with a newspaper and cardboard coffee cup. But that didn't prepare me for the shackles. Until that point, I'd only seen them on television, where cops restrained violent and nefarious criminals. I felt a flash of fear. Even though there was absolutely nothing to be afraid of, I could have restrained this tiny man myself with one hand. The patient saw my surprise and quickly covered the metal on his leg with his hospital blanket. We both tried our best to ignore the situation. He recounted stories about his grandchildren as I kept my exam focused above his waist to spare him any more embarrassment. Even though our interaction was civil and cooperative, I couldn't get over the fact that I was caring for a person who was chained to the bed. When I asked the police officer if he would remove the shackles, he shrugged and shook his head. He admitted that the man wasn't a danger. In fact, he told me that the man was being held for not paying parking tickets. I felt sick. I felt punitive and unnecessary. And I was shocked by the disproportionate response. I called the commander of the jail to request that the shackles be removed, but it yielded nothing. The best I could do was try to ignore the cold steel that punitively asserted power over this powerless man and tried to avoid the bias it stirred in me. Kindly old grandfathers with unpaid parking tickets are not the only shackled patients I have cared for. The Department of Corrections recently brought a patient to our hospital who was dying from COVID-19. Even though he had a breathing tube down his windpipe, requiring maximum sedation, he was cuffed to the ICU bed. His wife, who had been visiting remotely via iPad, watched as his bound legs snag against the bed rails when the nurses tried to turn him for a sponge bath. "Why do they have to shackle him in his dying hours?" she asked me. Why indeed? This man was only a few hours from his death, and any doctor, any civilian for that matter, would know he was no flight risk or danger to anyone. And yet punishment and judgment were being inflicted on him even as he lay dying in a semi-comatose state. He would have known that he was and always would be a prisoner until his death. Is that what we want for patients in our hospitals? It became clear to me that shackles on hospitalized prisoners are usually not about safety. They are instead a punitive act, cruelty without function. They are a demonstration of hierarchy, power, and punishment, things that have no place in a hospital. Shackles create humiliation and emotional harm for the patients and a sense of unwilling complicity for the people caring for them. Clinicians should be able to encounter patients who come under their care as unique individuals, untarnished by their penal history. A doctor should not be a judge or a member of the jury. If we allow the criminal justice system to have the ultimate say, we will never succeed in freeing the healthcare system and the people it serves from the shackles of bias, racism, and inequity. In effect, it makes hospitals an extension of the prison system, not the safe and non-judging places they need to be. I have tried many times over the years to get jailers to unshackle my patients. I've never been successful. I've made numerous calls to commanders at a variety of jails, holding cells, and federal prisons. I've been caught in a web of phone calls that go nowhere, permanently left on hold, or experienced verbal shrugs from the person on the other end of the line telling me that, "It's just the way it is, ma'am." In the case of Jacob Blake, it took widespread public outcry and increasing media pressure to get him unshackled from his hospital bed. My COVID-19 patient was untethered just moments before his death at my colleague's insistence. Patients who pose absolutely no risk to anyone should not have to be the focus of a media investigation or on the verge of death to be liberated from their shackles. Use of these devices should be the exception, not the rule. This moment, when the nation's attention is focused on reimagining the role of police and public safety, offers an opportunity to reassess the role the prison system plays in U.S. hospitals. As we move toward a model in which some of the power of the police is distributed among a wider network of social service professionals, hospital-based clinicians must have a voice in how prisoners will be managed in hospitals to ensure that doctors remain true to their mission, providing appropriate and humane care to every patient they serve. They should be empowered to advise on the most appropriate restraint situation if one is needed at all. If we take orders from the police, we are serving as lackeys of the prison system. Ultimately, collaboration between the healthcare and prison systems will make more both humane. As a medical practitioner with a mandate to do no harm, I would like to see us replace cold steel with warm compassion. We still have a long way to go, but putting an end to unnecessary shackling would be a start. Okay, well, I'd like to switch gears again in a big way with the coronavirus sucking up all the oxygen out of my public health reporting. I'd like to return to the single most preventable cause of death in the United States. Maybe not this week, but probably 3 or 4 months from now, and has been for many, many years, and that is tobacco. This from The Atlantic. The easy way for Joe Biden to save lives. Eliminating nicotine from tobacco products could help up to 5 million adult smokers quit within a year. There's an on-the-shelf policy the Biden administration could enact unilaterally that would save millions of American lives without costing the government a single cent on net. That policy, one pushed for but never implemented by the Trump administration, is eliminating most nicotine from tobacco products. It would not render cigarettes illegal. They would still be available to adults, and the smoking experience would remain much the same, but the product would no longer be so addictive. Researchers have estimated this policy change would enable 5 million adult smokers to quit within a year. The share of adults who smoke regularly would drop from roughly 15% to just 1%. 33 million fewer people would become smokers by the end of the century. It would save 8.5 million lives by 2100 at little public cost. I am always a bit suspicious of silver bullets in public health, Michael Fiore, one of the nation's leading experts on tobacco use and smoking cessation, told me. There are rarely silver bullets, But reducing the nicotine in cigarettes to near zero is as close to a silver bullet as you get. He's right, and there's nothing I know of in public policy remotely like it. Changing laws, medical advances, and social mores have saved millions of lives by suppressing tobacco use. But nothing more than a few pen strokes and a standard regulatory process, Biden could save millions more. As smoking has disappeared from television screens, planes, bars and restaurants, and other public places, the smoking rate has dropped to a third of its peak of 45% in the mid-1950s. The share of high school students who have smoked a cigarette in the past 30 days is down too, falling from 36% in the mid-90s to just 6% today. That latter figure is considered crucial among public health experts, as most adults who are dependent on cigarettes and who ultimately die from the habit start smoking as kids. Still, smoking remains a leading cause of preventable death in the United States. 34 million American adults smoke, 16 million live with a health condition related to the habit, such as lung cancer, emphysema, or heart disease. 500,000 die a preventable death each and every year due to their cigarette use. Other effects include lower productivity at work, higher rates of social isolation, and cigarette-induced impoverishment. Nobody knows this better than smokers themselves, the majority of whom want to quit, sometimes desperately so. Government data show that 2 in 3 smokers want to stop. In any given year, 55% try to stop, but just 7.5% manage to. Hyperaddictive nicotine is a major reason why. Public health experts have for decades suggested that the government require cigarette makers to produce products with non-addictive levels of nicotine. The American Medical Association started recommending the policy in the 1990s. The Obama administration took a major step toward the goal in 2009 by giving the FDA the power to regulate nicotine levels in tobacco products. The Trump administration, yes, the Trump administration, took another major step forward in 2018 when it started the rulemaking process to ban the sale of cigarettes with addictive levels of nicotine. Scott Gottlieb, Trump's former FDA director and arguably the best appointment Trump made, described the effort as a moral imperative. This was one area where the administration, so willing to slash regulations, public health consequences be damned, went full nanny state. No statistical model can truly capture the full impact of this effort, including the joy from years of quality life gained with a loved one or how much pain and suffering could be avoided for millions of families across the country, Gottlieb said. This unprecedented public health opportunity, contrasted against the cost of doing nothing, weighs heavily on me. Now it is up to Biden to save millions of lives and billions of dollars to the detriment of the tobacco industry and a few others. He could also enact important complementary policies, mostly without the need for new legislation. Those include banning mint and menthol tobacco products. The Obama administration banned the sale of flavored cigarettes, but not menthols. And the Trump administration banned the sale of flavored e-cigarette cartridges, but not menthol-flavored ones. It's hard to overstate how big a public health difference this ban would make, Matthew Myers of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids told me, given that most kids prefer flavored products. You would transform the history of heart disease and cancer in the United States. That policy action would have particularly significant health effects for black Americans, who were less likely to smoke than white Americans, but more likely to die from cigarette use. Menthols, which are more toxic and more addictive than unflavored cigarettes, have for decades been marketed aggressively to black communities, and 3 in 4 black smokers prefer them. The issue is contentious. Some black leaders argue that menthol bans are paternalistic, but many others argue that exempting them from flavor bans has a far worse racial impact. Fiore pointed to a suite of other policies that could help as well. Each of these options has a mountain of undisputed evidence saying that they achieve their outcome, he told me. They include tightening up regulation to ensure that tobacco products aren't sold to underage people, expanding anti-smoking advertising, enacting comprehensive bans on smoking in public places and on work sites, and making access to cessation tools and treatments universal, simple, and free. We have to make it easy to quit smoking as it is to buy a pack of cigarettes at the corner store, he told me. Another option is increasing tobacco taxes. Cigarettes remain far cheaper in the United States than many of our peer countries due to lower government levies. The average cost for a pack is $15 in the United Kingdom and $25 in Australia versus $8 here. Higher prices would have a particularly strong effect in discouraging teen use. But one caveat, low-income Americans are much more likely to smoke than high-income Americans, and low-income smokers often spend larger shares of their disposable income on cigarettes. Increasing cigarette taxes is highly regressive, a policy that burdens fragile and impoverished households the most. That's why policymakers should pair increases in cigarette taxes with other changes. ones that make cigarettes non-addictive, give support to people who want to quit, and ideally also help alleviate deep poverty too. This is a public health crisis of extensive proportions, hiding in plain sight, but Biden has a silver bullet to use. Okay, wow, can you go any bigger than that? That's the challenge, and I say yes. I will meet that with these next two stories. This from Civil Eats. Can local food feed big cities? Yes, if we cut down on meat. New research shows that shifting to lower meat diets would allow cities to source more or all of their food locally. This has been a banner year for local food, as the pandemic disrupted large-scale food processing and national and international supply chains. Many consumers turned to local food options, like community-supported agriculture programs, local meat processors, and urban farms. While the supply chain has since stabilized, many local food advocates are hoping that this new emphasis can help make the food system more resilient in the face of other challenges, like the climate crisis. Now, a new study from Tufts University provides the most comprehensive answers yet to an underlying fundamental question. With the majority of people concentrated in cities, how possible it is to localize food production in the U.S.? It depends, based on the type of food produced on surrounding land, based on where you live, and based on the type of diet, said Julie Kurtz, who spearheaded the research as a master's student alongside lead author Christian Peters at Tufts School of Nutrition Science and Policy. Using data on the populations of major metropolitan areas, estimated productivity of surrounding farmland, and food needs across seven different diets, researchers found that many cities, especially those in the middle of the country in the Northwest, could feed their entire population with food produced within 155 miles. On the other hand, many coastal cities would need to source food from much further distances to feed their large populations. And while generalizations are difficult, there is one big takeaway. In all regions, shifting to lower meat diets increased the potential to localize food production. That's where our model shows the most immediate opportunity, Kurt said. When you move to a 20% omnivorous diet, that's where pretty much the entire country can go local, with the exception of part of Florida and part of California. Of course, local food systems face many barriers beyond the mere existence of adequate farmland, including how to finance expensive infrastructure and compete with international corporations that produce vast amounts of cheap food. And while there are many ongoing debates on the benefits of localizing, experts say this kind of research is important to having a more informed conversation about the potential. One barrier in realizing the full potential of local food systems, said Ricardo Salvador, director of the Food and Environment Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, is that many people have a hard time imagining a world in which strawberries and pineapple are not available in Vermont in January. It then creates this expectation that unless we have that globalized industrial food system, we can't feed ourselves, that there really is no other meaningful alternative, Salvador said. The majority of us are so blinded by the fact that we won't even be open-minded about how much more we could do in terms of local and regional production. This study, he said, provides data to back up what is possible. The need for grazing land to satisfy the demand for beef is one reason people in many regions would have to source food from farther away, and why diets that include less of both can reduce the distance. Even cattle that spend the last part of their lives in concentrated animal feeding operations spend most of their lives out on pasture. Columbus, Ohio, for example, has enough cropland within about 200 miles to feed its population, but the range would need to extend out about 700 miles to include enough grazing land. If everyone in the city switched to a diet that included meat and other animal products at just 20% of meals, there would be enough grazing land within just 20 miles. Switching to vegetarian diets that eliminate meat but include milk and eggs would decrease the amount of land needed to localize production at a similar rate. However, switching to vegan diets does not further shrink the radius needed to grow local food. The Union of Concerned Scientists Salvador added, there are any number of farm families and rural economies that could be strengthened and thrive if they were the source of the supply for the major metropolitan areas in this study. And he sees those thriving food economies all over the country as potential insurance against disruptions caused by crises like COVID-19. One of the multiple lessons of the pandemic is that we become so dependent on the linearized industrial food system, so that if one part of the supply chain is disrupted, it has huge ripple effects throughout the entire food system, he said. Rather than take that as a one-off rare vulnerability, we should actually learn that we need a more resilient, much more distributed food system. Okay, well, there's a story with a lot of hope, but let's look at what we're up against. This from the Food Politics blog. Concentration in the food business, too high, too risky. A report to the Family Farm Action Alliance, the food system, concentration and its impact, shows just how monopolistic this industry has become. The CR4 metric is the percentage of a particular industry owned by the top four companies. The top four beef processing companies control 73% of all beef processing. The top four soft drink companies control 82%. The top three cereal companies control 80%. Anything over 50% is considered to be highly concentrated. So what's wrong with those in the high CR4 index? Agri-food consolidation reduces farmer autonomy and redistributes costs and benefits across the food chain, squeezing farmer incomes. In 2018, farmers whose primary occupation was farming, but with sales of less than $350,000, had a median net income of minus $1,524. An agriculture system without people has depopulated rural communities, causing a collapse in social relationships. Communities of color bear a disproportionate burden of exposure to excessive pesticide use or large animal confinement operations. What is to be done? At the heart of this analysis is a focus on power, both economic and political. Ultimately, American political democracy rests on economic democracy and vice versa. Thus, our laser focus in scholarship, praxis, and policy must be on democratizing the agri-food system through a multitude of strategies at local, state, regional, and national scales. Okay, my friends, well, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. You can queue up future shows or re-listen to this show or any past show by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. If you'd like to be notified when this show goes live, when I post the podcast file even before the air date, you can look up Just for the Health of It, WAKT 106.FM on Facebook, and like the page. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some